Yeah, we're looking at Parshas Yisro. We're looking at the idea of Matan Torah. And in particular, we're giving some of the background of the so-called ten Commandments. This is on page 406 or 407. We're looking at the background of the Ten Commandments, and we were talking yesterday about all sorts of things connected to that, the shape of the tablets, where the tablets were, where was the Aron HaKodesh, where was the Ark kept, where is it today. Those are kind of peripheral to the actual content of the commandments themselves. But now we can look at the commandments themselves. And the very first one is, of course, a very well-known verse. Thanks so much. It says, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, I am the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt from the house of slaves. Now that is said to be commandment number one. There we go. Sit down. And the big question, of course, is what is this commanding? You know, a commandment is to do something, not to do something. Even a statement, thou shalt love God, even though love is an emotion, at least there's a commandment to have a certain feeling. There is nothing in the way this is worded that suggests it's a commandment, right? I am the Lord your God who took you out of the land of Egypt, right? And yet, it's very, very clear from the Talmud that this is regarded as a commandment, and the proof of that is the following. All of us know the well-known rabbinic teaching that there are 613 commandments in the Torah. Right? We know that. That's a well-known teaching, although it's not so easy how to get that. If you sat down with the Torah, I'm not going to get into the details of this, and you tried to write down how many thou shalt and thou shalt nots there are in the Torah, you would come up with a lot more than 613. You would come up with something like 5,000. So obviously there is some type of classification system that's working here. So for example, when the Torah says, bring a sin offering, so the Torah says, do A, do B, do C, do D, right, do D, do E. So you can actually find in a sin offering something like, you know, 25 commandments. But we don't count in the listing. We don't count, everything. Slaughtering the sin offering, sprinkling the sin offering, eating the sin offering, burning the sin offering. We don't count it as separate commandments. We have something called bringing a sin offering, which includes, in other words, there has to be a theory of classification, meaning to say the 613 are really Shabbos, right? We say there are 39 categories of work that you're not allowed to do on Shabbos. We don't count that as 39 prohibitions. Rather, we have one prohibition called do not do forbidden work on Shabbos, which is defined by 39. So, without getting into the theory, Maimonides went to very great lengths to try to kind of figure out what fits under what and what fits under this, what fits under that. But be it as it may, the bottom line is that we do have 613. And many of them don't apply today because they only apply when there's a temple or whatever. But of the 613, we have a division into 248 positive commandments. How many thou shalt do in the Torah? Tefillin, Shema, right? Those are positive commandments, 248. And they correspond, it is said, to the bones in the human body, that you actually have 248 bones. And actually, that's even anatomists today say that is true until you're around 18. Because what happens around 18 when you complete your growth is that certain bones are fused with cartilage. In other words, like this.
I think there are more than that. If I remember what I was taught in health class in high school, I thought there were 300 bones.
No.
Or is it closer to 200? I remember being taught it was closer to an even number 100. So.
Well, okay. I remember the number 248 was considered accurate, but what happens is that some bones fuse. So you lose your count a little bit later on. So you know you lose your memory, you lose a lot of stuff as you get even slightly. You'd be amazed that people think the years of decline are when you're 70. The years of decline is like when you're 21. You're already declining in some in some significant ways. But be it as it may, you got 248 positives, and then you got 365 negatives. Thou shalt not, you know, eat treif or whatever it is. And that too has a symbolic meaning, either because of the days of the year, that like every day you sanctify by refraining from refraining from violating the Torah, or alternatively, there's a number that's given that there are 365 sinews or ligaments in the body. Now that number I have not verified with modern science, but the concept is that it gives life to your ligaments. But be it as it may, the 613 number is a symbolic number. Now, the Gemara then goes on and says that there's a gematria that supports the idea of 613. Gematria is what? Although it's connected to the Greek word geometry, but it's not geometry, it's just arithmetic. And gematria is the simple idea that every letter of the Hebrew alphabet can also have a numerical value. The same way that A could be 1 and B could be 2, so Aleph is 1 and Bays is 2. And the gematria of the word Torah, that Moshe gave us Torah, so let's figure it out. Tuf, which is the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet, is 400. Vav, which is 6, the next letter of Torah is 6, 406. Resh is 200, so that's 606. And Hey is 5, 611. So the Gemara asks, well, it's like close but no cigar. In other words, you're telling me there's 613 because that's the gematria of Torah. Well, Torah is 611. Torah is not 613. So the Gemara says, no, you're missing the point. Moshe was God's intermediary to give us 611. But the first two commandments of the Decalogue we heard directly from God. And the first two commandments are, I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt, which is one. And two is, thou shalt not have, one positive, one negative, thou shalt not have any other gods besides me. So therefore, it works out perfectly. And then what happened was, in the book of Deuteronomy, we're told that the Jews were afraid of hearing God's voice directly, and they asked Moshe to be the intermediary, and all the other commandments we heard via Moshe. God spoke to Moshe, and Moshe spoke to us. So now it's very beautiful. Moshe gave us Torah, 611. We heard two from God. Right? This is the Gemara in Maseches Makos. But what you see inferentially is that I am the Lord your God is counted as one of the commandments. Because that's exactly what we're saying. We're saying that and the next one were the two that made up, when you add the Torah, gives you 613. So the question does become, well, what is it commanding, right? It's a statement. What is it commanding? So here we have, I'm sorry, do you want to say something?
Well, yeah. I just had a quick question. With the 365 representing do not do this,
right.
And you said one possible explanation is days of the year,
yep.
But in the Hebrew calendar, there's not 365.
Yeah, that's actually a very, very interesting question.
Where does that come? Where does that idea that it's the days of the year come from?
Well, it comes from the Medrash. The Medrash mentions it. The rabbinic literature mentions what's called... See, you have to understand that Jewish law is not in, or Jewish Judaism is not indifferent to a 365. 365 actually does represent a natural cycle. In fact, as a year, 365 is more of a cycle than 354, because 354 is simply the number of days of 12 lunar revolutions around the Earth, right? A lunar revolution around the Earth is around 29 and a half days. So since we never make Rosh Chodesh a half a day, so we average it out with 30-day months and 6 29-day months, and that gives you an average year of 354. But there's nothing that happens in a year, so to speak. You know, a lunar year is not an event. A lunar year is the sum of 12 monthly events. By contrast, a solar year is actually an astronomical event because it represents... At least after Copernicus, we would describe it. It represents the amount of time that it takes the Earth to go around the sun. See what I'm saying? In other words, so even though it's true that the Jewish calendar is based on lunar cycles, but it does recognize the astronomical phenomenon of the sun.
You averaged factoring in leap years. When you average all the average years, you get 365 anyway. Right.
Yes, eventually you will. That's actually a very good way of putting it, because remember we talked about the fact that the Jewish calendar does have to have a solar adjustment because the Torah requires that Passover be in the spring. And since in a pure lunar calendar, you're going to have a shortfall of 11 days, right? A solar calendar is 365, a lunar is 354. So what's going to happen is Passover is going to get 11 days earlier progressively every single year till it'll eventually fall in the winter, right? Everyone remembers that idea. In other words,
that's why,
right.
The Muslim holidays are always...
That's right, that's right. So the Islamic calendar is pure lunar. And because it's pure lunar, its holidays can fall any season. Now, actually, that's pretty good for them, because when they have Ramadan, which is a month-long fast, you know, it's much easier to have, you know, during the day, it's much easier to have Ramadan in the winter than in the hot summer. So Ramadan, right, right. So especially since, you know, I saw a statistic, which is unbelievable, that 98% of the construction workers in Israel are Arabs. That's 98%.
So they don't have to work on the past.
So you really see that during these hot, long summer days, you know, they're doing construction work and they can't even have, if they're really, I mean, not every Arab is, just like, you know, you have conservative Reform Jews, you have conservative Reform Muslims too, and not every Arab is so strict on this, but those who keep the Ramadan and are in construction during the summer, that's a very, very rough time. But because of the Jewish idea that Passover has to be in the spring, so the way we get around that is around 7 years in a 19-year cycle, 7 years in a 19-year cycle, we add a leap month right before the month of Nisan, and that's called the second Adar. And whenever Passover gets too early, it's approaching the winter, we kind of have a month that pushes it late. And then another 3 years, early, then push it late. And that's how you get the adjustment. So because of that, you're actually correct if you averaged all of the average length of a Jewish year, taking into account leap years, because a leap year is 383 days, right? You'd actually get a 365. So that's a very good point. And that could be why Chazal used 365 as essentially the average year. But be this in May, going back to the problem here, the problem is, well, I am the Lord your God who took you out of Egypt. You know, what type of commandment is that? So Maimonides asserts it is a commandment. Maimonides says, this is the commandment to believe in God, which is a pretty amazing thing. There's a commandment to believe in the Almighty. Don't be an atheist. Believe in God because you yourself experienced that God took you out of Egypt. Now, Maimonides, right, in Hebrew is Rambam. And Rambam, we know, is an abbreviation for, as we do in Hebrew, Rabbi Moshe ben Maimon. In fact, Maimonides just means son of Maimon. That's the I-D-E-S in Latin. The great rabbi who often argued with him was a younger contemporary, Ramban, which is Nachmanides, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman. And just to give you just a sense of comparative geography here, Maimonides lived most of his life in Islamic countries, and basically his career was in Egypt, in Cairo, and he was the personal physician of the Sultan there. Nachmanides lived his life in Catholic Spain until the very end of his life, when he was kicked out of Spain for discrediting Catholicism in a public debate, and he made his way to Israel. So Nachmanides actually died in the land of Israel. Strangely enough, and I've asked people, and like, you know, it seems to be a confusion, although Maimonides lived in the diaspora, but when he died, he was buried in Israel, and Maimonides' grave can be found in Tveria. Now, that itself is very, very odd. Like, why on earth is he buried in Tveria? I mean, if you're taking a body from Egypt to Israel, you generally are going to hit Jerusalem, or at least near Jerusalem, way before you're going to hit Tveria. So why would they bypass Jerusalem
to
bury him in Tveria? Again?
Maybe he was on the way to the spot? Because Tveria is in the north, right?
Yeah, that's right. Well, Maimonides wasn't a Kabbalist, so I'm not sure if Svat wouldn't have that same attraction in those days. So, be it as it may, though, Maimonides is buried in Tveria. And on the other hand, Nachmanides, who we know died in Israel. It seems we're not sure where he's buried. Like, where is Ramban buried? I don't know. I mean, so many graves of rabbis in Israel. You know, Israel's filled with graves of great rabbis. Tour guides are even inventing pilgrimage. You know, I mean, the great rabbis, where they say, you know, on yard sites, on the anniversaries of deaths, they like to arrange tours. So I see now they just pick out, like, you know, new rabbis from the hat to say, oh, the yard site, we're going to go, you know, here. But for some reason, we don't know where the kever of the Ramban is. Strange question. If you have
Kever's grave,
yeah, the grave, very, very strange. But be it as it may, Ramban and Rambam always argue on different issues, and usually their disagreements are very enlightening. They say have different views of things, and Ramban raises the following logical question on Maimonides, and he says, "How is it possible for God to command that you believe in Him? Because here's the thing: if you believe in God, then you don't need to be commanded to believe so. But if you don't believe in God, what is the source of the authority that's going to make you listen?" It's like if you were to tell an atheist, you know, the atheist has whatever his arguments are, or an agnostic, whatever his arguments are, and I simply address his arguments, "I'm sorry, sir, you're not allowed to be an atheist because God says you're not allowed to do that." Well, but his argument is, if there's no God, why do I have to listen? So, who are you commanding to believe in God? Because of this, Nachmanides understands this. Now, it's a question, how is he going to interpret the Gemara? The Talmudic passage is difficult, because the Talmudic passage indicates it is a commandment. But because of this, Nachmanides says that the proper way to classify, "I am the Lord your God," is not that it's a commandment, but it's a predicate and a foundation for the commandments that come. Meaning, God is not addressing non-believers here. God is talking to the generation that experienced the Exodus, the generation that experienced God's miracles at the splitting of the Red Sea. And God is saying, "You know, fellas, because I am the Lord your God that took you out of Egypt, you owe me obedience, and I'm going to tell you how to live your life and how to serve me." So technically, you would call, according to Ramban, you would call Anochi, "I am the Lord your God," you would call it a meta commandment. By that I mean, it's not a commandment per se, but it is a foundational predicate establishing the duty of obedience, right? We must be obedient to God, because as the rabbis describe it, actually, because since God took us out of our slavery, God owns us, right? God says, "I took you out of slavery. You are now my slaves. You are now the people that serve me," and the like. So that's Ramban. On the other hand, as I say, Maimonides does at least have one Talmudic passage that supports his argument. And how would Maimonides answer Nachmanides' point? How can you command somebody to believe in God? So the way Maimonides himself addresses it is very, very fascinating. And that is, there are two different ways people believe in God. Some people believe in God, in fact, maybe most people believe in God, simply because this was the tradition that was passed down. They were raised as a child to believe in God, and they have what you might call blind faith, or they have what's called simple faith, the faith of tradition. And then there is what you might call the philosopher's faith, the faith of the person who has rationally persuaded himself of the existence of God based on logic and based on philosophy. And Maimonides very much favored the second way. So essentially, the way Maimonides understands this verse, God is addressing himself to the believer and saying, graduate beyond the simplistic faith of the tradition and try to internalize this as a rational component of your essence. Now, without getting into too much discussion, I just want to point out that this was an enormous debate in Jewish medieval philosophy, and it continues to be a debate that's raging even today, and that is, should Judaism, as an abstract matter — it's a kind of an abstract question, but it has practical repercussions — should we encourage intellectual explorations into the existence of God? Or should we try to encourage people just to accept it? Now, again, obviously, when people are coming from the outside and didn't have religious background, it's kind of a meaningless question, because if somebody comes and is not convinced about God, then you have to deal with it intellectually. But let's talk about it internally. Let's say you have a group of Jews who were raised in Mea Shearim, right, and they were raised to be religious and the like. Should we introduce, as part of the curriculum, kind of the intellectual predicates for the existence of God? Or is the attitude, well, maybe don't open the Pandora's box. If somebody believes in God, why should you automatically trigger the questions, the doubts, the uncertainties in the assumption you'll come to a good resolution? You know, maybe you're leading people down a road that might cause them to leave faith. And that is why, as you may know, Maimonides' own philosophical works, The Guide to the Perplexed, which tried to demonstrate the existence of God through logical processes, were very controversial among Jews. And there were Jewish communities that excommunicated those books. There were even some communities, although this was very extreme, Jewish communities that burnt those books. Okay, so it's a bit of a controversy. I had mentioned either, I'm not sure I mentioned here, I mentioned to another share, but I'm repeating, that you may have heard of one of the most beautiful and important books of Jewish ethics. Is a book that even predated Maimonides. Now, the Kuzari predated, but there's another book, and that's called Duties of the Heart. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's called Chovat HaLevavot, Duties of the Heart. It is available in English. It was written by a Spanish rabbi. This is before the Catholic conquest. This was also under Islam. Rabbi Bachya Ibn Pakuda. Rabbi Bachya Ibn Pakuda. It's called Duties of the Heart. And it's really a classic book that is still widely studied today. It was written in Arabic and then translated into Hebrew. And he discusses, you know, the ideas of submission to God, humility, repentance, introspection, all those things. But the first chapter of the book is called The Gate of Unity, and it attempts to philosophically demonstrate the existence of God, based on tenets that were common in Aristotelian and then Arabic medieval philosophy, which essentially modeled itself on Aristotle. And it's interesting that we have all sorts of comments from the Gaon of Vilna, who lived in the 1700s, to the effect that the Chovas HaLevavos is a wonderful sefer, but you should only start from chapter 2. Do not read chapter 1. And there's actually almost kind of a of course, that'll probably make you want to read chapter 1, but there was almost a moratorium on chapter 1. Don't open those questions, you know. Start from chapter 2, which talks about ethics, and don't go to chapter 1 that talks about, you know, the existence of God. So once again, the Chovas HaLevavos was a forerunner to Maimonides. Maimonides took much of the same approach. But as I say, within the Jewish religious tradition, there was a tremendous controversy until you get to someone like Rav Nachman of Breslov. Now, again, that's hardly someone that's totally mainstream, but Rav Nachman of Breslov basically totally mocked the idea of philosophical understandings of God, and he said that the only legitimate faith is a simple faith that trusts, like a child trusts a parent, without getting too intellectually sophisticated about it. So it was actually a mark of derision for the person to explore the existence of God through the pathways of philosophy. And I mentioned even Rabbi Halevi in the Kuzari was somewhat disparaging of philosophy. So you have an interesting issue here. Maimonides considers philosophical exploration of God to be the essence of what this commandment is. Not just permitted, but that is this commandment. And there were others who considered that to be a very non-kosher type of inquiry because of the negative consequences that it could have. Now, as I say, for guys like you and guys who come to Or Sameach, this is a bit of an empty debate because obviously if there are people who come who are not yet convinced, then obviously the issues have to be addressed. But the question becomes, if somebody believes in God, you know, should we, in a regular, let's say, elementary Jewish school, you know, should one bring up those issues? Or does one say, hey, if they believe, you know, let sleeping dogs lie, don't open questions.
But what if they don't believe? Just because the fact that a group of people are going to be raised in a very religious environment, such as Mea Shearim,
to be very simplistic, the issue becomes the ignorance is bliss type of approach. Mm-hmm. Meaning to say, is it safer? Well, we'll talk about it in a grossly pragmatic way. Is it safer for the long-term survival of Judaism to simply shut off certain avenues of inquiry, and that will keep people faithful? Or do you have the opposite argument, that by not addressing certain issues, people will eventually realize that there are questions that need to be answered, and if they don't have answers, that is more conducive to people leaving Judaism? Now, the short answer is that different people will be affected in different ways. For some people, they will remain good, faithful, loyal Jews, not even knowing that all of these questions may have existed. For other people, it'll have the opposite effect. So really, just as in terms of pragmatics, you're just making a decision, what's better for the long-term religion, so to speak. Now, this is not just the existence of God. I mean, that might be the big one, but all sorts of things, evolution, age of the earth. I mean, in other words, basically all of these types of questions of trying to reconcile the Torah with various aspects of science and the like. And the question is it better when you have a relatively, not in America it doesn't work because you don't have a closed society, but if you have a relatively closed society, is it simply better to shut off certain things or to engage with them? So again, as I say, this is a major debate among educators, among schools, among families, as to what is the best way to raise our children. Yeah.
What's the norm in more religious communities?
To be frank, in what you call the ultra-Orthodox community, again, that's a bit of a pejorative word in some ways, but among the Haredi community, the point basically is ignorance is bliss. There's no question that, by and large, people do not want these questions to be addressed. But as I say, as we see kids who get exposed to the questions and are not getting answers within tradition, there is indeed more recognition is beginning to emerge that you have to address questions. You can't sweep things under the floor. But the historical mainstream had been not to address it.
Christian idea, just have faith. Don't ask about it. Don't question. Just believe.
Well, let me say this though. Let me say this. It is reminiscent of it. But let me just say there always was one big difference, and that is the following. When it came to ultimate issues, is there a God? There indeed was a feeling often, just believe it. However, given those premises, within those premises, Jews were encouraged to debate. If you study Talmud, for example, so what you might call the whole Talmud is about what you might call second level debate. By second level debate, I mean, we're not going to prove that there's a God, that's a given, and we're not going to prove that he gave the Torah, that's a given, and we're not discussing that. But what are the implications of that? How does it play out in this case, and that case, and that case? Now, the whole Talmud is not blind faith. The whole Talmud says, let's use our reasoning, let's use our argument. So the one thing I want to say is that even if it's true that within, let's say, ultra-Orthodox Judaism, there was a notion that primary fundamental principles are taken as given and are not necessarily open to question, even if that was the way things worked. But within that framework, there was always active interaction, debate, discussion, and that's really what Talmud is, right? So unlike the Catholic Church that kind of wanted to foster ignorance, in fact, they were even against people learning to read. The reason illiteracy was so high in the medieval times in Europe was the Catholic Church did not want people to read the Bible. The Catholic Church wanted only the clergy to be able to read the Bible and tell people what it meant. Now, with Judaism, it's exactly the opposite. It was always the opposite. The mitzvah is every single Jew is supposed to learn the Torah. Every single Jew is supposed to be able to understand things. So I would differentiate between what you might call, actual fundamental principle versus a second-level argumentation, which has always been encouraged at a very, very deep and interactive level. So there you do have a big difference. In fact, it's really, really amazing. The non-Jews recognize this as well. Gutenberg invented the printing press, 1450s or something, 1453, I remember a date. Now, do you know that the first printers in Europe were printing Jewish books, Hebrew books? And
really?
The printers were largely non-Jews. In fact, the first Talmuds and everything were printed by non-Jews who employed Jews to do the work. Now, why would a non-Jewish printer be so interested in printing Jewish books? Because there wasn't much of a market in non-Jewish books. Nobody knew how to read. So if you were in it for the money, you would tap the Jewish market. So the
had the money to spend to begin with, right?
Not necessarily. But the point was that Jews treasured books. Jews treasured learning. Every Jewish kid learned Hebrew and learned Chumash, the Torah, and learned Gemara, etc. So there was a market. So the first printers, I mean, they were Christians. Daniel Bamberg in Venice, etc. Sansino Press, which is still around. Sansino was like the earliest press. The first Talmuds were printed totally by non-Jewish people, but they obviously employed Jews to do the proofreadings, do the typesetting, and the like. Because they understood that if you want to sell a book, you got to go to the Jewish market. You couldn't go to the non-Jewish market in those days. Okay. So it turns out that the academic debate, the very important theoretical debate between Nachmanides and Maimonides, actually turns into a raging educational debate in terms of how do you present issues to school children and young adults who grew up in a religious society. Okay, now be it as it may, focusing on the actual verse itself, right? I am the Lord your God, who took you out of the land of Egypt from the house of slavery. So as I indicated, this is establishing the foundation of obedience. And the commentaries ask an obvious question. If God is trying to establish that we have to obey him, why does he choose the Exodus? He could have chosen something even more fundamental than that. He could have said, I am the Lord your God who created heaven and earth. Right? That's even a bigger claim. Then I took you out of Egypt, the house of slavery. So, say again.
Maybe it's because they didn't see.
Right. So there are a lot of different answers that are given. One is that God wants to stake out his claim with something that this generation had actually experienced in their flesh and blood. Creation of the world, was an old event, and they could say, "Well, who says you did it, God? Maybe." You did it with a bunch of other gods. Maybe there was polytheism or whatever.
What does that mean to me specifically?
Yeah, or for example, Aristotle argued that there was eternity of matter, right? That was the solid state theory that matter always existed. So God has to come up with something that's directly relevant to their lives. That's the simplest answer. A second answer that is given is that God wants to establish a unique relationship with the Jewish people. Now, it is true that God as creator obligates the world to obedience, but it's not a specific claim against the Jewish people as his nation. And the specific claim on the Jewish people would, of course, be the Exodus. Right? So that's a second reason. And a third reason, Nachmanides advances, why it emphasizes the Exodus, is the idea that there was a religious philosophy that did believe that God created the world, but God was no longer actively involved in the affairs of man. In fact, let's take someone like Einstein. Einstein absolutely believed that there was a divine, he was actually a deeply religious man in a certain way, in what you might call a non-theistic way. He did believe, by examining the elegance and ultimate simplicity of the laws of nature, that how a few basic laws, and of course he was searching for one law, he was searching for a unified field theory, he didn't find it exactly, but basically the concept is that all of the millions of phenomena in the universe can be reduced to a few basic laws. And therefore within that complexity, there's an elegant simplicity. He saw that as evidence of something emerging from a unitary intelligence that kind of coordinated these laws. So he very much believed that there was a creator, there was an architect, there was an intelligence that guided the operations of the universe. But Einstein refused to accept the idea that this intelligence was concerned with the individual decisions of human beings. Right? The intelligence was the architect of all of these laws, but then like the watchmaker who makes the watch, the universe kind of operates by itself based on these laws. So the what you might call the non-theistic belief in God that someone like Einstein had, did not accept the possibility of miracles, per se, at least on a conscious level. There's no God that's doing miracles. Did not accept the idea that God cares, you know, if you get up before 9 o'clock or not to say the Shema on time and the like. So there is a philosophical school that might accept the existence of God as a supreme architect, but does not consider God as having any connection to the individual decisions that people make. So the Ramban writes that God, in this first commandment of the Decalogue, wants to negate that philosophy by pointing out, I am not just the God of creation, I am the God of history. I interact into the affairs of man. I punish evildoers like Paro and Egypt. I bestow love and kindness on those who keep my commandments and the like. And therefore, this is moving away from an emphasis of God as creator to God as active presence in the daily lives of man and in human history. So, Bekitzor, to summarize, therefore, we have, I think, three different reasons, although they overlap, why this verse emphasizes the Exodus rather than creation. Number one, this was an event that was personally experienced and therefore was much more powerful. Number two, it establishes a unique claim on the Jewish people as opposed to everybody in the world. And number three, it demonstrates God's ongoing involvement in human affairs as opposed to the impersonal God who was the architect of the universe and then was simply no longer involved. Now, I remember many, many years ago, I was teaching a class on the laws of Tisha B'Av, you know, the ninth of Av. And one of the laws of Tisha B'Av just happens to be a law that, you know, because it's a day of mourning, we're not supposed to wash our hands totally. Yom Kippur is the same thing. We only pour water on our hands until the first or second knuckle. Because you're not supposed to give yourself the pleasure of washing it. So I remember a woman just was very irate. A woman simply said, are you telling me that the infinite God has nothing better to do with his time than caring if the water goes up to my second knuckle or beyond? He says, is that, you know, how God spends his time? Well, one answer might be, well, if you have infinite time, you know, you have plenty of time. He says, God has nothing better to do with time. Well, God has plenty of time. But the short answer is, without giving a direct answer to that question, is that yes, Judaism makes the claim, and maybe it's a supreme egotistical claim, that we are so important to the Almighty that every little thing we do with our lives makes a difference. It matters. God cares. God is not the impersonal creator of the universe who doesn't care what the hordes of millions of people do, or billions of people do. Everything we do matters to the Almighty. Creation has a purpose. And yes, God does care. Now again, that particular, you know, every case you're going to ask, you know, why does God care? On that's another question. But she was making a more general statement that she could not perceive how the architect of the universe could care about the microcosmic details. And the answer is, indeed, that is the case. Okay, well, have a good Shabbos. We'll see you on Sunday.